This is Sustainable East End, a monthly show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Southampton Town is a coastal community of almost 300 square miles, half of which is water. Due to more intense storms and rising sea levels, the town is vulnerable to severe coastline erosion and the loss of its sole source aquifer and electrical power infrastructure. The town is confronting these challenges with a series of initiatives to fight the impacts of the climate crisis and to reduce its effect on the government. John Bouvier is a Southampton Town Councilman and the liaison between the town board and its Energy and Sustainability Committee. We sat down recently with John Bouvier at Southampton Town Hall to discuss these issues. John Bouvier, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tony Ernst, my co-producer, and I are here to talk about, among other things, your role as the town council person, the liaison to the town's Southampton's Sustainability Committee, and also what the town has been doing in terms of sustainability. So we're going to talk about energy, and we're going to talk about water quality and climate, the climate crisis also. First of all, just tell us, what do you do as the liaison? What are the responsibilities of the liaison, the town councilman liaison to the Sustainability Committee?
Well, it's actually multifaceted. We have a group of people who are very concerned about our environment, our energy needs, and they form a group of very talented people that work to inform the board and to help us craft legislation that's geared towards helping our energy needs, our environmental needs. So everything from, we've had plastic bag bans, styrofoam plastic bans and things like that. A lot of energy needs. We have a great chair, Lynn Arthur, who really drives me hard to, on the energy side of things. And the whole idea is to promote sustainability in the town for the obvious benefits that we'll derive from that, and both our planet and our people as well.
What have been some of the most notable things that the town of Southampton has done, has already accomplished? You mentioned the plastic bag and the styrofoam. What might be some things in terms of energy that the town has accomplished?
Well, quite a number of things. One of the things that stands out to me personally is we had worked with NYSERDA to transition all our streetlights in the town of Southampton from incandescent bulbs or mercury vapor lamps to LEDs. And obviously, we had great energy savings, but we also had savings that we could pass on to our taxpayers. As a result, it's about $270,000 reduction in costs. But there's an equivalent reduction in gas emissions as part of that as well, greenhouse gas emissions as part of that. So, and that's equivalent to about 85,000 gallons of gasoline burned. That's the equivalent of 96 million cell phones being charged per year. So we have a tangible benefit, which is the cost. And then we have the intangible benefit. It's a little harder to quantify. But those benefits are the greenhouse gas emissions, and we also, in the process of doing that, have installed remote controllable dimming for the lights, so we can meet our dark skies compliance. We have a great dark skies committee that work on that. So there's a multitude of things that go into that. I'm quite proud of that. That was actually done through our Parks Department. I'm quite proud of that. More recently, we've offered a CCA legislation, which is community choice aggregation. This is a very successful program that was, there's about 50 municipalities in New York State that are doing this. Westchester, I think, was one of the first, and they're sort of a trendsetter. So I went digging to look into their legislation, and what that allows us to do, hopefully, and we're in the process of studying it. So we need to understand what our consumption is, what the numbers are, to give our board an informed decision. And to do that, we've hired a third-party broker, a company that will then go and collect all that data for us, with the goal of driving our costs down per kilowatt hours for our consumers, but also offering our consumers the ability to choose where they might get their energy sources from. so they could get it from alternative sources, not simply fossil fuel, but other alternative energies. So that's a great program. Those are two that come to mind right now.
Listeners to this program are well aware of the threats to all of us on the planet of the climate emergency, the climate crisis. But what are some of the concerns about climate, about the climate crisis that you feel are specific to Southampton?
Well, clearly we're a coastal community. So obviously we're worried about our beaches and what we do. We have a large revenue that's derived from property tax, obviously, for homes that are built on, you know, the beautiful views and the oceans that we have here. And the concern, obviously, is going to be over time. What do you do? Do you raise homes? Do you pull back? Do you retreat? And there's a lot of people that have a lot of different ideas. Obviously, the one thing we don't want to do is create hardened structures to hold back sea level rise. So,
and why is that?
Well, for the aesthetics, obviously, for us out here, but we've also seen that those kinds of structures are sort of a stopgap. It's a finger in the dike, so to speak. We have to be a little smarter about that. So I sit on the Peconic Estuary Committee, Management Committee, and we look at living shorelines and more natural ways to protect our coastlines as we start to see sea level rise. So there are a lot of studies going on, particularly in the estuary, which is really to see, to understand what those effects are. So we can project by looking at the topography where we're going to have low-lying areas. And then obviously the larger threat of that is you get saltwater intrusion into the aquifer. We have a sole source aquifer here. All our drinking water comes from that one place. And as sea levels rise, you begin to get salt water that pushes into the aquifer. And along the coastlines, you start to get mixing. And that's problematic as well.
Has that already happened? And if it does, which it might be more like a when instead of an if, what are the plans on how to deal with that?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's what we're all wrestling with right now. I sat on the Superstorm Sandy Task Force for the county, and that was one of the large subjects. So, what do we do, and how do we do it? And I think it's sort of human nature to wait for disasters before reaction, but we're in a slow motion disaster here, and we need to do something about it. A lot of the estimates are that by 2100, the year 2100 will be past the tipping point. And that's not very much time in the scheme of things, particularly the way people work and, you know, human nature is the way it is. I think the time to start that is to change the culture and attitude, which we've worked hard in Southampton to do that. And we're seeing the results of that from our septic system programs, you know, the contribution of nitrogen to the bay systems and our groundwater. These things are all sort of related. But it's difficult to project into the future, to think what's the right path and what's the right sequence of events and things to do. And that's what we're wrestling with now.
You're listening to Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Southampton Town Councilman John Bouvier about efforts to fight the effects of the climate crisis and reduce its effects on the environment. Talk about the connection between the climate crisis and the nitrification crisis.
Well, one of the byproducts of climate change are more storms and more water, more harder rainfall. We have much greater runoff problems than we did 50 years ago, even less than that. So when we have these intense storms, we have to manage that water, that runoff. Because typically it picks up products off your lawn or off of old agricultural facilities where you have phosphorus-based fertilizers or nitrogen-based fertilizers, which are about 65% of the contribution. How do we manage that runoff? So typically in the past, most municipalities would just build superficial infrastructure, and they did not consider that the sediments that were being born were actually containing a lot of these things. And so you'll start to see that it's more pronounced in freshwater bodies. But the reason we have these large algal blooms out here is largely because nitrogen is not a contaminant in as much as it's a food. And so it promotes the growth of algae. And algae grows so quickly that it cuts off light to the bay bottoms. And then when that dies, that sinks to the bottom, and bacteria take over, and it sucks the oxygen out of the water, and we get fish kills. And so you see the symptoms of it. Trying to put the science together in a way that's comprehensive to the average person to understand what their responsibilities are, That was when I first campaigned. I remember going to doors and talking about water quality, and eyes would roll. And I'm really heartened to see now that this is a mainstream conversation. You know, we understand our individual responsibilities, but as a township, there's so much that we can do. And we're fortunate in New York that we have a governor who's putting a lot of money into that. So there's a lot of grant money available to us. We have a CPF fund, which we use about 20% of that fund. The CPF fund is a transfer tax. So when everybody buys or sells a property, 2% of that money goes into a fund, and we buy property for community preservation. That can include land preservation, historic preservation, all those sorts of things, parks, things like that. But it's also the 20% of that allows us to begin trying to fight the problem of nitrogen, which includes infrastructure to manage that I was just talking about, but also we started a rebate program. So we want to encourage all our residents to get septic systems that mitigate nitrogen. So your typical septic ring, it mitigates somewhat, but the IA, what we call IA, innovative alternative systems, they take roughly 65% of the nitrogen out. It's a big deal. And I should point out that we have for the last 16 years, we've had brown tides up until 2 years ago. And for the last 2 years, and I'll knock on wood, that we haven't had a brown tide. And I think that's kind of remarkable. I would like to say it's because we have instituted this rebate program. We put in more IA systems, septic systems, nitrogen mitigating systems throughout the town of Southampton than the county has. And I'd like to think that that's it, but I'm pretty sure I'm an engineer by profession. I'm pretty sure it's actually that there's been a paradigm shift in the way people think about their responsibilities. So they may not put as much fertilizer on their lawns. They may think twice about what they do. And I think that's starting to show. At least I'm an eternal optimist. So I'm hoping that's what it is. So that's really the program with the CPF is a big deal for us. But the county also offers a grant program. So for the town of Southampton, we offer up to $20,000 to replace the system. In our high priority areas, which is what we call the 0 to 2 travel time, that's on the coastline. That is
0 to 2.
0 to 2 is we try to measure how long it takes water to go from the source to the water or to the groundwater. And so along the coastlines, it's usually 0 to 2 years it takes it to go from one place and actually end up in the bay water. And there's Suffolk County has instituted a sub-watershed study, which I just got briefed on a couple of days ago. So we'll be able to measure that and map that a little more clearly. And our next phase here is to widen our mandate. We started out with a mandate for those 0 to 2, those homes located in 0 to 2 new construction, and then substantial reconstruction. Our next phase will be to go to widen that to put more systems in the ground as we go on.
You said that the town of Southampton has permitted more of these IA septic systems than the county has. What percent of the total does that represent? How many more are remaining?
Well, that's a great question. It's a small amount. That's why I'm hesitant to correlate the systems that we put in with the loss of brown tide. There's, you know, as an engineer and a scientist, that you look at things over a longer period of time to see, you know, what anomalies might have occurred, what situations may have resulted in a peak or a change that may not actually be a trend. So you need that time to really see that. So in the town of Southampton, we have good numbers. The East End, East Hampton, our neighbors as well. We're a climate smart community here, and that enables us to provide more grant money and things like to do those other things. But it's relative to septic systems. We have a lot of cesspools. That was that was the way it was always done. You know, you dig a hole in the ground, and that's pretty much it. And then you have a cistern, and that was pretty much it. And there are natural processes that that eliminate nitrogen to some degree, and other, you know, pathogens. And it was pretty much, people were more worried about the pathogen than they were worried about nitrogen. And that's only a new thing that we've learned through a lot of scientific study. So treatment plants were built that didn't consider nitrogen at the time that they were built. So, you know, you have to think about that. So we see it as twofold. One is we have old septic systems and cisterns and cesspools, but we have a lot more people flushing them and a lot more homes. And so the amount is quite high. So there's roughly 365,000 individual septic systems in Suffolk County. Our percentage is about 15. We probably have more individual septic systems because we don't have sewage treatment plants. But what we do have are cluster systems, what I call cluster systems, and that's the ability to take the same technology I just talked about with the IA systems and cluster those together so that where we do have high density, people can hook up to those systems. And there's a cost savings, there's a scale benefit there for them to do that. But typically, our geography doesn't allow for big treatment plants, but also treatment plants are built in a way that projects future use. So big sewage treatment plants project 15 to 20% growth onto that. And some people might say that promotes density. So we don't take that tact. We are working with communities where we have homeowner associations, where the group of people of neighbors may want to gather together and actually benefit by lowering the cost because they have more people hooking up to the systems, or purchasing the systems in bulk, or many different methodologies. So one of the things we've done with our water quality program is to purchase lands that we now have available to purchase that we might not have in 10 years. And we're putting those lands aside for use to put in cluster systems in those high density areas to be used, potentially used in the future. We're not gonna mandate it, but we're saying to ourselves, that property might have a house on it in 10 years or something might happen to it. Let's buy it, let's put it aside, and then let's offer it up to put a cluster system which is tailored to feed only the houses that previously exist.
Are you working with the Peconic Baykeeper on the NOIAC project with this? Is this the community septic idea, basically?
Yeah, that idea has been floated. I don't know where they are right now. One of the issues, and it was proposed to us by Peconic Baykeeper, but one of the problems is that you have to have the place to put the cluster system. And if you don't have that, then you have the alternative, which is to put individual systems into all those homes, which is also perfectly fine. The new systems are designed to take the same footprint as old septic rings. So pretty much they go in. But, you know, we were talking before about sea level rise and those issues. We now have the issue of rising groundwater. Although in the summer, our groundwater actually drops because you have so many people using water for irrigation. So at times we have a problem with not having enough water. And then there are times when we have the problem of having too much water. And that's the saltwater intrusion. It affects some of the aquifer underneath those and causes it to rise. Or if you're close to water, you have a very high water table. So these systems are designed to sit in those water tables. They're disconnected from it. But there are still issues, you know, retaining walls we've had to deal with. So when we rolled out this program, I was very adamant about going slowly so that we could learn, and we did. And I think it was the right thing to do because we've learned a lot. What's the right way to do it? Be able to change our zoning laws to accommodate these things, and also wait for the technologies and the vendors to adapt to putting these systems in. And so far, it's been working pretty well.
Well, that's great. Recently, in the last few weeks, the state of New York announced a 50-year plan to deal with, to replace all of these old, aging, nitrogen-polluting septic systems. Has this changed the picture at all in terms in Southampton, in terms of your planning and in terms of the resources that might be available? More money, for example, to cover maybe people, to get rid of the income cap on being able to get some of the subsidies? With this new 50-year plan, does that change anything? Does that change anything for the town of Southampton going forward?
Well, certainly. You know, we have a perfect example of that is West Hampton Beach at the airport in West Hampton, Gorbetsky Airport, is a sewage treatment plant that's being put in. And we work to have that plant hook up to West Hampton Beach. So where you have these high-density areas, those are, you know, city small towns on the waterfront, typically that's where you see a lot of the density. West Hampton Beach is fortunate to have the ability to hook up to that. If we didn't have a state that was providing that kind of funding, you know, an individual sewage treatment plant can exceed the total funding that we have available just in our CPF. You know, it can exceed $16 to $20 million. So to have partnership with the state and to have people that are understand the magnitude of the problem and how do we start fixing it, that's very, very important to us because we won't be able to afford it just with the CPF fund. We need to have the help of our county and our state, and that's working.
We heard this month that, or last month, that the town of Southampton has set two goals, and one relates to renewable sources for electricity, and the other is to be carbon neutral. So can you elaborate on that?
And explain what carbon neutral means.
Well, our goal of energy independence is part of the carbon neutrality. So every time you burn anything or produce power through a generator or other means, you're using fossil fuels, and they have corresponding gas emissions. You know, it's like the exhaust coming out of your car. So we established a goal of 2025 to become energy independent, which is a lofty goal. And one of the ways to get to that was what I was speaking about before, the CCA, or those types of programs that help do that. Because ultimately the goal of we have a goal of 2040 to be carbon neutral. And that's part of that plan.
And what does carbon neutral mean? Because, you know, I believe the new New York Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, the original proposal was to be fossil fuel free. And then people talk about carbon neutral. There seems to be a difference between them.
I think they're totally related. What we're trying to do is to minimize carbon emissions, which is one of the greenhouse gases. But you know, there are other greenhouse gases. There's methane. We don't have that as much here because we're not, you know, a livestock and agricultural. But to get carbon neutral is to basically try to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions as much as possible. Get to a point where what we're putting out is equal to what we're getting back is equal to what we're producing.
And that's in not just in power generation. In other words, you're talking about community-wide, that is buildings, transportation.
There's two programs that we're working on now towards that goal. One is the what we call the commuter hub, which is a way to provide alternative transportation for people. We're working with the MTA, created new train stops for employees and it's largely teachers and professionals that are moving from west to east and east to west. And how can we get more and more cars off the roads. We're looking at ways to provide vendors with safe staging areas for their equipment so that they don't need to bring their equipment all the time. We also have one of the most stringent HERS ratings in the town of Southampton. HERS is a measurement of efficiency. So a typical home, you know, leaks energy by heat or when you turn on your air conditioning, you know, if you use a lot of energy, you want to keep that contained. You don't want to just let it go. So we have, I think, one of the highest residential HERS ratings, and we're working now on commercial HERS ratings as well. And that is another way to reduce the dependence on fossil fuels, because now people are consuming less. So it's interesting to us because we had seen from some LIPA and PSEG presentations to us that they projected that our that our consumption was basically at a 45-degree angle over the next 20 years. And we've actually done our own study to realize that we're either flatline or actually declining, and it's largely because of those HERS ratings. And it's one of the reasons we want to go to CCA, is to be able to confirm those numbers and work with LIPA, which does a good job, but it's a regulatory agency, and we have to work with them to find ways to accomplish our goals, but you know, also meet their regulations. So it's an interesting dynamic right now.
Now, HERS, that applies to new construction, is that right?
Yes, it does.
So what you're saying is that because of new construction and some of the other, you know, maybe the whole package of what you're doing, you're focusing on keeping the energy consumption trajectory flat or declining, as opposed to what LIPA had projected for this region, which was upward, and was giving them the reason why they wanted to build peaker plants around here.
That's correct. And you know, they had a goal. Our power is, our generation is based on what's called peak load, which is basically an 11-day period where we consume the most energy. And it's largely because people have their air conditioners on and the swimming pool pumps, which is another big one. So you have this line that suddenly peaks. And under their regulations, they have to produce a percentage more power than that to be safe, to keep power. We've had this year alone, we've had three curtailments because of power consumption. So this is a reason why those agencies are driven to produce more power. So they're looking for ways to do that. We agree, except that we're not that happy with using peaker plants or natural gas productions, or oil-driven or coal-fired plants that produce electricity. So with CCA, we're being encouraged, and we're hoping it isn't going to incentivize us to be able to produce local power that we can then offer to our residents as well. That's either through wind or through solar, but also through other means of parasitical energy like tidal. We have huge tidal differences. So we're exploring all sorts of ways to generate power through those different means. And that's just part of what I think you need to do your due diligence to ultimately end up meeting that goal. So it's not just a lofty goal that someone, you know, gets elected for a period of time, they say the goal and they walk away. I personally am really trying hard to make it so it's bulletproof, so that the next town board that comes in that might have slight different approach, that this is a goal that the town is on, a path it's got to take.
Well, it sounds like Southampton is really in the forefront, certainly on Long Island, and I speak as an East Hampton resident. I'm also a member of the East Hampton's Energy Sustainability and Resiliency Committee, and I think we do look to Southampton as a leader in this, and it certainly has been borne out in talking with you. John Bouvier, thank you so much.
Thank you. And I just want to say that we partner with East Hampton a lot. You know, Gordon Rackey sits on both these committees, and there's a lot of people that are devoted to getting this goal done. And I don't think it's just done by one municipality, but rather a group of municipalities working together. That's CCA is an example of that, but also alternative energy productions, different taking advantage of different technologies, emerging technologies. That's all part of the same goal that we all have. And I'm really excited to find out that our nearest neighbor, Riverhead, is working to become a climate smart community as well, which is the first step that you take to get to have this ability to take advantage of some of the monies that are available and do all these good things. So if we work together, we're gonna do fantastic things out here, and I think we already have.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. We spoke with Southampton Town Councilman John Bouvier, the town board's liaison with its Energy Sustainability Committee. More information about some issues and programs discussed are at the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA, website. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at this time. Programs are archived at www.sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.